Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Richard Urosky is my name, and I represent the appellant Stephen Roth. Mr. Roth, as is clear from the briefs, was a substantial stockholder of Meritor Savings Bank at the time it was seized and placed into receivership with the FDIC.
Mr. Urosky, what did Mr. Roth sold those shares?
That is correct.
What did the buyers think they were getting?
Well, it's a little hard to know, but based on the sale price of 3 cents a share, not very much.
Oh, really?
I think
based on the sale price, they didn't think they were getting all right title, interest, and possession, which is the normal sales.
They couldn't have. Because of two distinct reasons. One, the legal context for claims of the sort at issue here.
Was Mr. Roth aware of that legal context?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Did he use the United States mails or interstate communications to sell that stock?
Probably.
And if he did, isn't that a violation of the federal securities law if he's transferring that with knowledge that he's not actually selling those rights?
Absolutely not, for two reasons. One, the legal context at the time that occurred for claims of this nature, namely claims arising out of a bank seizure, were most charitably described as confused and murky. Nobody had any idea.
You just told me Mr. Roth was perfectly well aware of his rights.
I'm coming to that part. The second part of my answer is there was, at the time that sale took place, a class action, an alleged class action in place called Slattery Against the United States, and Mr. Roth was a member of the class on whose behalf recovery was sought. So any purchaser who was knowledgeable had to know that there were competing claims being made in an existing lawsuit, not based on ownership of the shares at the time Mr. Roth sold, but based on ownership of the shares at the time Meritor was seized.
And Mr. Roth told the buyers that they weren't getting those rights. Is that Mr. Roth,
this was an anonymous sale, inter-broker sale. They weren't told anything. As is typical in market sales, there are no representations made one way or the other. They're inter-broker transactions.
Before your time runs out, can I just shift gears a little to another one of your allegations, which goes to the breadth of the order that was issued by the Court of Federal Claims?
Yes, Your Honor.
That doesn't affect that breadth doesn't affect your current clients, correct? I mean, they've got the $7 million set aside for them, which I assume someone has calculated is the difference, right? So your objections with regard to the breadth of the order does not impact your current
It should not affect Mr. Roth's ability to receive relief.
So your complaint about the breadth is to potential people that might appear in the future that have a claim?
Who would have the same claim Mr. Roth has? That it is the date of seizure.
Well, the same legal claim, not the same claim. Mr. Roth is going to get his money or not get his money based solely on how we construe the statute and not based on the breadth of the order, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, I stand correct.
If we, just hypothetically, if we were to disagree with your statutory construction point, in other words, Mr. Roth loses, does that moot the other argument as well? I mean, I assume the other argument, to the extent if you acknowledge it's limited to future potential shareholders who have not yet been identified and who are not in Mr. Roth's group, your group of current clients, that claim would be predicated on their being construed as shareholders that are entitled to the claim.
That is correct. It would certainly prejudice their claim.
Would it? Wouldn't they be able to come in with a clean sheet, and that the nature of an order entered in a case in which they weren't a party or privy, it would seem to me, unless they are in privity, would be functus officio, right?
That's why I said it would prejudice their claim, because it's the legal holding, as I understand the question, would be that the controlling date was the date that the distribution of surplus was made, or more technically, judgment was entered directing the distribution of surplus, as opposed to the date the bank was seized.
I think I missed a step there. Okay, I'll sort it out.
Well, no, so I make sure I understand. So if we were to construe the statute as meaning that the shareholders that are entitled to compensation under the statute we're looking at are those that own the shares at the time of the CFC award and not going back to when receivership took place, then that would dispose essentially of any future argument others might make that deal with construction of the statute.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. Your Honor, Mr. Ross' argument before this court, I think, is quite straightforward. This is purely a question of statutory interpretation, namely whether the phrase depository institution shareholders, as used in Section 1821, refers to shareholders at the time of seizure or shareholders at the time judgment is entered.
By the way, I think given that we've asked you a lot of questions, you can go ahead and make your principal argument without regard to the fact that.
And I think I can do that good. Very briefly, right. Your Honor. Because the argument that Mr. Roth is advancing is predicated in part on the distribution section of Section 1821 and partly on the receivership formation section. Those are obviously related sections. And the main point is that the receivership formation section is so comprehensive, is so plenary, that it sweeps the rights and economic interests of the depository institution and all its constituencies, stockholders, depositors, directors, and so forth, into the receivership. Consequently, there is nothing left in the shares of the what is then the shell corporation. And that assumes that there is a shell corporation. In one prominent case, indeed the only other prominent case we've been able to locate where there was a similar distribution made, which was the Seuss case, the government dissolved the failed institution, and therefore there could be no shareholders because there was no corporation. And notwithstanding that, it was held in Seuss that a former stockholder could maintain a derivative action on behalf of the now seized institution and prosecute that claim. So we believe and assert here that the continued ownership of shares in the shell is not determinative of rights in the distribution. Those rights are purely statutory and derived from the distribution section of the receivership statute. That is our main point. And that point is either held directly in First Hartford or it is very, very close to being held directly in First Hartford, where the rights are described as statutory rights, where there's recognition that there is a legally protected economic interest at the time the receivership is formed in the shareholders who owned the institution at the time it was seized, and that economic interest matures into a legal right at the time it's determined that there is a surplus to be distributed.
Mm-hmm. So, is it your belief that that interest is completely unalienable under any circumstances?
I don't think we need to reach that question. I think our position is that it cannot be sold so that the buyer would have a claim against the surplus or against the FDIC as receiver. There presumably could be a private arrangement whereby the seller commits to transfer the proceeds of any recovery to a buyer. But we do not believe that that interest can be sold. It's not a share of stock. It's a right to participate in a receivership.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Vasquez. We will reserve our return your 1 minute. Or what did you have, 2 minutes? 2 minutes rebuttal time to you. Mr. McCarron.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Jeffrey McCarron on behalf of the movement and appellant John McCarron. Pending before this court, Your Honors, is the appeal of the order by Mr. McCarron denying his motion to intervene and also that order relating to the distribution of the surplus of Meritor to the shareholders to the complete exclusion of all others, and also without regard for the distribution scheme provided in 12 U.S.C. 1821 D11 relating to the priority of distribution. Now, the Court of Claims denied McCarron's motion to intervene, and the court did not deny that motion to intervene for any reason which relates to Rule 24, and of course Rule 24 relates to intervention. Instead, the court denied intervention because of lack of subject matter jurisdiction and also for res judicata. Both of those reasons for denying the motion for intervention are wrong, and they are also improper reasons for addressing a motion for intervention. This court realizes, I'm sure, that the intervention is provided for in Rule 24, and it's Rule 24A2 specifically, which relates to this case because it was intervention as of right in the court. That is, the Court of Claims realized that it was Rule 24A2, and it decided, but it did not decide the factors relating to Rule 24A2 intervention as of right. Instead, it went on to decide simply that there was no subject matter jurisdiction, and it did not decide, and it did not, and it also decided that it was precluded because of res judicata. However, that decision should have been simply whether to grant intervention pursuant to whether those factors provided for in Rule 24A2 were satisfied or were not satisfied, and of course, the jurisdiction and then the res judicata issues would have been properly addressed, if at all, at some point in time after a decision on the motion to intervene. Instead, the court didn't even decide the motion to intervene, which Rule 24A2 requires. It is not a discretionary decision for the court. It is mandatory. If the factors in 24A2 are satisfied, which according to the court's decision suggests that those factors were, or at least wasn't indicated that those factors were not satisfied. I mean, the court went on to say that Mr. McCarron had a interest which he needed to protect, and the parties in the case were not in a position to protect his interest. In fact, they were likely to be adverse. Consequently, it is apparent that the Rule 24A2 factors were satisfied, and it was error for the court to deny intervention. The court's decision based on jurisdiction is not applicable in the sense that subject matter jurisdiction is not needed for intervention motions. There's no independent jurisdiction requirement, and this courts of the country have decided that, especially in instances where you have a court as the Court of Claims, where there's limited jurisdiction, there is ancillary jurisdiction is sufficient to supply that source of jurisdiction over which the court can decide the claims. But in any event, the court went on to decide those very issues, not relating to McCarron's claim or a motion to intervene, but with respect to who should be the recipients of the distribution of the assets of the Meritor estate, which it either had jurisdiction to decide or it was no different than McCarron's situation, and the court had jurisdiction to make that decision about whether he was appropriate candidate to participate in the distribution of those assets. Consequently, the jurisdiction reason expressed by the court, that is the absence of subject matter jurisdiction, was error as a basis to deny the motion to intervene. Res judicata doesn't apply because, of course, res judicata depends on the existence of a decision which is based on the merits. There was never a disposition on the merits either of Mr. McCarron's claim as presented in the motion for intervention or the motion to intervene. Previously, there had been a motion to intervene filed in 1996, which held the court held on to for 10 years until 2006, and at that time expressed.
What about the proceedings that took place in the 90s in the court in Pennsylvania and the Third Circuit?
Those proceedings were against the receiver, and they were based on a claim in the receivership. At the time, it was there hadn't been an adjudication that there was surplus, and it was at a time when the decision was whether – rather, the decision made by the Third Circuit after the court, the district court had made a decision was that pursuant to the receivership statute, the receiver, the FDIC as receiver, could repudiate the contract. But it did not address the issue.
Are you bound by that decision?
Well, in the context of what happened then, thereafter, where it was decided by the court and upheld by this court that there was an improper receivership.
Well, is that really what the holding was? I mean, I thought the holding was simply that FDIC breached its memorandum of understanding with Meritor.
Well, the court of federal claims went on to express that the receivership was improper, that it should never have taken over the bank as a receiver. Should not have imposed the receivership on the bank and then awarded damages as a result. But the court can't use, or rather the government can't use, the receivership statute as a way of cleansing and eliminating the valid debts of the institution which never belonged in receivership in the first instance. Of course, we know that from 1821 D11, which provides that there's a distribution scheme, not unlike you would experience or have in bankruptcy court, where if there's a surplus, as there definitely was and is in this case, then the distribution has to be to creditors in advance of distribution to shareholders. The shareholders can't experience a windfall by defeating the claims of creditors, valid claims of creditors, because that would boost them above where they would have been in the event there hadn't been a receivership. The whole contention by the shareholders, or rather Meritor, because, of course, the shareholders are receiving it only derivatively because of their interest in the institution. The whole position by Meritor is that it was an improper receivership, and, of course, that the government breaches contract by eliminating goodwill as a factor to be considered in a capitalization requirement. And so, therefore, what happened was the government never should have imposed a receivership. You know that because the Court of Claims upheld by this court decided that the award had to be net of all the receivership expenses, which otherwise would have been allowed if it had been a proper receivership, and instead made an award net of all those expenses and net of taxes.
Okay. Your time has expired. We'll reserve your
Thank you.
Rebuttal time, and we'll hear from first Mr. Mizuguchi.
Good morning, Your Honor. Am I allowed to use my 12 minutes? And however I wish to allocate them.
Sure, sure.
And I'm joined by counsel at the FDIC.
That's fine.
And may it please the court, we respectfully submit the court should affirm the trial court's decision because denying the Roth intervener's claims because that decision is in accord with the plain text of Section 1821D11, and it's also in accord with the prior disinterested determinations of the FDIC when it has confronted this question in the Benjamin Franklin receivership, and in this case, before the trial court, when the FDIC had no stake in the issue in terms of which shareholder or non-shareholder would be paid, but rather just wanted to make a determination to do the right thing and apply the statute that it is charged with administering correctly.
You know, I'm not sure that plain language gets you very far in this case. It seems to me shareholders is the question is what is the meaning of the word shareholders, and simply say, yeah, these guys are shareholders, people that now hold the pieces of paper that say Meritor stock, and therefore case over. Well, Mr. Yourofsky's argument is they're not shareholders. They're just holders of a piece of paper, which is essentially monopoly money. Now, why is he wrong? Other than telling me that the plain language of the statute for shareholders.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, first of all, starting with the text of D11, it doesn't just include the word shareholders, although that, we would say, is definitive. It also tells you when you look at that question. It says after the receiver has paid all higher priority claims, the receiver shall make a distribution to shareholders. So you have that temporal aspect.
Right. But once again, the people that now hold these pieces of paper are not shareholders because the corporation ceased to exist. There was no further interest to be held by way of a shareholder or anything else. Then that argument, again, brings you back to the people who were shareholders at the time of the receivership, right?
No, Your Honor.
If not, why not?
Because there's no basis for saying that people who – that the shares that Meritor issued cease to be shares in Meritor just because there's a receivership.
Okay,
I understand that the argument of the Roth interveners is that Section D2 of 1821 is what commands this argument that essentially shares cease to exist. That's not a correct reading of 1821 D2. The reason it's not correct is this. If you look at the text of D2, it is true that it has some sweeping language about once a receivership is imposed, that the general powers, in fact, that's the caption of D2, the general powers that are conferred include rights and titles of any stockholder or depositor with respect to the institution. That has never been construed to mean, for example, if you're a depositor, that suddenly you no longer have deposits. It has never been construed to mean just because you're a shareholder in a bank that goes into a receivership, you no longer own your shares. So it does confer the right to manage the bank on the receiver. It does not strip the private property of the depositor or the shareholder. And the question that was asked earlier is a good one. If that were the case, what did Mr. Roth think he was selling?
Well, I guess the answer to that is he was selling the possibility that you would win this case.
Well, and he got compensated for it too, Your Honor, because
but that doesn't, that doesn't mean that he was selling nothing. I mean, he was selling something.
He's selling
some value, and indeed, if you win this case, we'll turn out to have a lot more than $51,000 worth of value.
And what he received under market theory was the fair market value of the possibility that this case would produce a surplus payout. So he's already been compensated exactly for what he might have been entitled to as a shareholder. He sold his right to participate in a distribution to another. That other person, assuming they still hold the shares, is the shareholder within the meaning of D11 who is entitled to be paid, and many of whom have been paid. The other way you can tell that D2 doesn't strip a shareholder's ownership of its shares just because there's a receivership is when you look at the absurd result that occurs when you match up the D2 language with D11. If it really did mean that, then D11 would be meaningless because if there were no shareholders after the point of receivership, then when D11 says to the receiver, after you've taken care of paying all prior creditors, then you shall pay shareholders. Well, under the Roth intervener's interpretation of D2, there are no shareholders after the day of receivership.
Well, the shareholders are the people that were holding the share, by their theory, or the people that were holding the shares on the, at the moment that the receivership was instituted, right?
And D11 says those shareholders of Meritor shall be paid.
Right. And but so if those are the shareholders, then you've got your shareholders.
But that further qualification, Your Honor, that does not appear in the language of D11. Congress said you'll pay after you pay the prior creditors. This is in the receivership, past the point of receivership. Then you shall pay to a shareholder. If Congress had intended to change what is the plain language of the statute, which basically says pay the depository institution's shareholders, it presumably would have added language to the statute to clarify that something other than what appears in the text needs to happen, and that is that even if you no longer are a shareholder, so long as you were a shareholder on the day of receivership, that's who gets paid.
No, but so your suggestion is the language, as long as all Congress would have to do was to put in shareholders as of the date of receivership.
if that is what Congress had intended, but we submit that is not what Congress had intended.
It turns corporate law on its head.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that brings me to the second prong of our argument, and that is amicus in this case before the trial court were current shareholders who had bought after the date of receivership on the understanding that they would own all the rights that accrue to a shareholder. The trial court took note of this, and it held that if there is any ambiguity in the statute, then it's appropriate, and they agreed with our position, to look to common understanding of law when shares are transferred. When shares are transferred without any disclosed or agreed upon restriction on what gets transferred, everything gets transferred. Whatever, so even if the distribution in theory is being credited back to Meritor's shares on the date of the receivership, those shares were transferred by Mr. Roth to another for consideration. And he got paid the fair market value at the time. Presumably, he took a tax loss deduction at the same time, too. So his recovery now would be a windfall.
What about the breadth of the order? How would the trial court have the right or ability to foreclose all future litigation?
Well, the answer, Your Honor, is the full scope of our potential liability is the $276 million affirmed by this court. The trial court told us that after nearly 20 years, it was going to direct that the award be paid out without waiting for Mr. Roth's appeal to end. Because there's an escrow, Mr. Roth is taken care of in terms of whether there may be any need to pay him. But there were no other claims, Your Honor, before the court. There have been no other claims made like Mr. Roth through intervention. So nothing the court did was inappropriate in that it simply foreclosed and made final our liability with respect to the $276 million.
Well, and foreclosed, at least putatively, somebody who hasn't emerged yet but might.
Well, to the extent...
Or do you say that they haven't been foreclosed, notwithstanding the language of the court's order?
I'm sorry, the first part of that, Your Honor.
Well, in other words, what we're concerned with here, I take it, is somebody that pops up and says, you know, I'm in the same position as Roth. And I frankly, with all apologies to Mr. Yourofsky, I don't think he made the right arguments. I've got a better argument for showing why I should win. And he goes into the Court of Federal Claims and he presents his case. Do you think that he's barred by the order that was entered in this case by the trial judge?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, first of all...
Why? Because he wasn't a party to that action unless he's in privity.
No, but the subject matter of the action, Your Honor, is the $276 million breach of contract derivative...
Are you making a kind of in rem type argument? I mean, why would he be barred since he wasn't a party to this action? It doesn't matter what the breadth of the order that was entered in this case, does it? I mean, he could have said, and what's more... No one will be able to bring a contract claim against the United States for the next 5 years. That doesn't bar anybody except parties to this case.
Well,
correct? I mean...
And there are no other parties to this case.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, that's the concern is, well, about the breadth of the order, right?
Yes. To the extent that any individual had a claim to participate in the distribution... That, in the ordinary course, would be something we would consider to be under the jurisdiction that governs the FDIC and a matter you would take to the FDIC and take up through the district court. It's only the accident of history in this case that Mr. Roth's claims have been permitted to be entertained as if the receiver was the United States. If somebody else wanted to make that kind of claim, they should have intervened in a timely manner sometime within the past 20 years.
Well, it's
years.
A different argument to say they'd be untimely. Fine. If they're untimely, they bring a case next year and they're untimely. But they ought not, the argument is, or at least you ought to be defending why they can be foreclosed, not because they're untimely, but because the judge in this order foreclosed them from bringing it. He didn't say because anything filed past the state would be untimely anyway, so I'm going to sort of rule on that question, even one that's not before me.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What about Mr. McCarran's arguments? I'm going to turn to those.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. McCarran's, there are two reasons, principal reasons, why Mr. McCarran's appeal should be, or rather the court's denial of his motion should be affirmed. First of all, Mr. McCarran's claim at bottom is a claim predicated upon the employment severance agreement that he had with Meritor. It was a 3 years of annual salary of severance. That claim has already been litigated in the district court, affirmed by the Third Circuit. So the predicate of his would-be intervention is something that's barred by issue preclusion, claim preclusion, and that was one basis on which it is appropriate to affirm the court. The second one is the very nature.
So it's appropriate to decide that issue and resolve that issue in the context of the rule with regard to intervention as opposed to allowing him to intervene and then disposing of his claim because of those reasons?
But, yes, Your Honor, because, well, there are two. The second reason I was going to bring up is there's a lack of jurisdiction to entertain the nature of the claim that Mr. McCarran is presenting. Again, his claim is based on an employment agreement with Meritor. Meritor is a private party. It is essentially a dispute between two private parties, Meritor and Mr. McCarran. The Tucker Act does not permit entertaining that claim. An intervener has to have a claim that's vindicable in the intervener's own right to come in, and that's the 441, I think it's 14th Street case we cite. Mr. McCarran, unfortunately, does not have a claim vindicable in his own right. It's a claim against Meritor. The receiver did repudiate that claim, but that was pursuant to the receiver's statutory authority to do so. That decision was affirmed by the Third Circuit. It's final. There's nothing. His problem is that he lacks a claim to bring to the receiver and say, oh, I should be paid first, because his claim has been precluded by prior litigation. And his other problem is that he can't really bring that claim into the Court of Federal Claims and say, see, I should be paid, because the Court of Federal Claims would have to look at what is the nature of his claim. And the nature of his claim is one over which the trial court lacks jurisdiction.
Now, turning back to the res judicata issue, what do you say to Mr. McCarran's argument that the there is no res judicata effect of the prior litigation in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania Third Circuit because the receivership has been found to be invalid?
The first defect with that, Your Honor, is that that argument is premised on the notion that there was a holding in this case to the effect that the receivership was invalid. That's not the case. The holding in this case is that the FDIC corporate breached a contract with Meritor. So what...
Which had it not breached, the argument is there would have been...
Right, but, but at the time that the FDIC dealt with Mr. McCarran, it dealt with him under its statutory powers to administer receiverships. One of those powers includes determining whether to affirm or repudiate contracts with the failed bank. And in this case, the FDIC receiver determined that a three-year golden parachute would be a burden. It repudiated the
contract. So you're saying that, I take it, that the fact that the receiver or its predecessor has breached a contractual obligation does not render everything that the receiver does in its capacity as a receiver invalid. And
correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And even if we're invalid, it's final as a result of the prior litigation. There's nothing to reopen.
Okay. Very well. We do have a question.
Yeah, I do.
Just a second.
And that is on the timing of someone popping out of the woodwork with another claim. I don't see that they're foreclosed. That is, from a collateral attack, from coming in and saying, in effect, the judge was wrong when and attacking the finality of that decision as it applies to them. I want you to discuss that.
Well, Well, Your Honor, our position is that the United States' maximum liability is the $276 million.
Uh-huh.
Right? And we've paid that out pursuant to the trial court's order. For someone to come in under the Tucker Act and make the kind of claim you're talking about, which we would ordinarily maintain, is something that would have to be taken to the FDIC directly under its statute and litigated there, and if disputed, to bring it up through the district court. To come here, though, rather, they would need to have come, in our view, in the same way that Mr. Roth did, in some timely, more timely intervention dealing with this question that we're dealing with right now. So is it – no, you're right. It is possible that someone could come in and try to sue. If they were to do that, I think we would be asserting what I just asserted. Or they could go to the FDIC and make that kind of argument.
We'll reserve. No, you don't have rebuttal time. That's right. You're after
right.
me. Sorry. We will hear from Mr. Buchanan. Mr. Buchanan, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thomas Buchanan for the plaintiff appellee, Mr. Slattery. We just have 2 points to make, Your Honor, and we made those in the brief, but that is that we support the position of the United States with regard to Mr. McCarran. We believe he fully litigated his contract claims in federal district court in Philadelphia. He appealed them and lost. In order for him to pursue a claim against the estate, he would have to establish his contract claims first because obviously he was suing the receivership, and if there's no money in the receivership, he can't recover any damages. But the first thing he had to do is establish liability on his contract claims and then collect, and then he would collect against the estate. He failed in the first instance. He appealed. He lost. He tried to intervene, and he lost because he didn't have a claim for liability. We also have a position with regard to the sort of rightness of these claims that are being advocated by Mr. Roth with regard to other shareholders who sold their shares and who may come forward. We don't think those claims are right for him to proceed on those, and we don't believe he has standing to pursue those. He has protected himself, Mr. Roth, that is, because we have reserved $7.6 million to cover his share should this court rule in his favor. But we don't believe he has standing to proceed on behalf of any other former shareholders of Meritor Savings Bank. So that's our position.
So your view is he doesn't have standing to challenge the scope of the order?
Mr. Roth has standing, but he doesn't have standing to challenge it on behalf of other shareholders who have sold their stock. They had 6 years from the breach to pursue their contract claims. They didn't pursue those. Mr. Roth or others could have come in within that 6 years and pursued their claims. They could have brought a class action. They failed to do that. So you have to have a contract claim in this derivative action to recover. No one else has pursued that. In fact, no one else has made a claim whatsoever. I think the court has discussed this in the concept of, well, could someone come in administratively to make a claim against the receiver, say, I was a former shareholder, I wanted to claim. My view would be that they would have had to claim within 6 years, according to the statute of limitations.
Well, yes, but that may be, but we're mixing apples and oranges here. I mean, Judge Prost's question, I think, was about the scope of the foreclosure by the sweeping nature of the trial judge's order. Your response is, well, they'd be untimely. Those are two different things. Maybe they would be untimely, but the question that has concerned me, and as just Prost's question, is setting aside untimely, suppose that there just weren't a timeliness problem. Suppose there weren't a problem of non-intervention in the Roth action. Would the order itself foreclose then?
Well, I think incumbent within the order is the notion that they didn't. No one else has come forward in a timely fashion, although not stated therein. That was something that was discussed in the briefs that led up to the order. But, yeah, someone could make an administrative claim at this time with to the receiver. But in the normal course, what the receiver would do is, okay, show us proof of your claim. And that would be the shares. And so it would be denied. Then they could go to district court and challenge that. I think they could do that. I think, practically speaking, the order by having all the money distributed except for the $7.6 million has made it difficult for anyone else who may have a claim to come forward. So
are all booked shares in the possession of someone? That is, do you know that all booked shares are held by a
believe that there are 6,000 shareholders who have collected, who held 95% of the shares, and they've been paid out. I believe there's approximately 10,000 shareholders who have not made a claim. And that accounts for about $11 million, which is less than 5% of the total. And considering that, you know, the time frame that's gone by, and I've dealt with other receiverships, it's not uncommon that people have died and moved on. So, but the FDIC has sent out notices to all the shareholders of record.
Very well. Let's see. Mr. Yourofsky, I think you have we give you your 2 minutes back.
I'll be very brief, Your Honors. First thing I want to point out on the question, which is the primary question on this appeal, about who the proper shareholders are to receive the distribution. The government has not taken a consistent position on that question throughout the litigation. When the plaintiff, Mr. Slattery, sought to amend his complaint to alter the class he was protecting to shareholders on the date of judgment as opposed to shareholders on the date of seizure, the government said the following, quote, "This court should consider the appropriateness of a class action in the context of those persons allegedly injured at the time of the act complaint of, not those who are speculating on this lawsuit." And the basis for the government's position at that time was that this was a derivative action and there is case law under Rule 23.1 that says the purpose of a derivative action is not to prosecute claims of people who are trading in controversies, that it's against the policies underlying Rule 23.1. My second point is that selling shares does not necessarily entail selling every right and power associated with the shares. The most common instance of that is where shares are sold after a record date and the seller retains the right to vote the shares or receive a dividend and so forth.
What is the, there's a restriction. It's subject to a restriction.
And our argument is that in this case, the restriction is even more universal because the shares have been deprived of all rights associated with them. And it is the shareholders.
Well, you're selling, what you're saying is that your client is selling something valueless, which is why I asked if you were selling it interstate.
In selling something not valueless, 3 cents a share, and worth 3 cents, for the ability to assert a claim that eventually was honored by the claims court. I think this court should be aware that every current holder of shares has been offered compensation. Either compensation has been paid or compensation has been offered and not claimed. And that quite apart from the $7.5 million reserved for Mr. Roth, there is, as counsel observed, approximately $11 million simply unclaimed here. So it's not as though the people who bought those shares have any kind of legitimate grievance about not receiving what they're entitled to. They got more than what they're entitled to.
Thank you, Mr. Yourofsky. We'll,
thank you, Your Honor, for giving me the honor of addressing the court.
Thank you. Mr. McCarron,
if I may, just make a few points quickly. It is not the situation that in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania case, which then was taken to the Third Circuit, that there was ever an adjudication with respect to the validity of the contract claim. The only issue presented in that case, the only issue that which was decided by the courts, was whether the claim could be properly repudiated by the FDIC as receiver, or whether there was some white knight exception to the rules relating to receiverships. That was the only and sole issue. It was never adjudicated that McCarron did not have a contract-based right to
I thought you just said what was adjudicated was that the receiver was entitled to repudiate the claim.
The repudiation piece.
Right.
So Buchanan and also the government suggested the idea that the contract claim was decided, meaning whether he did or didn't have a contract, whether the circumstances triggering the obligation to pay were satisfied under the pursuant to the provisions of the contract. Those issues were never adjudicated. There was never any debate about the issues, in fact, because everyone acknowledged that the circumstances giving rise to the payment obligation existed, but for the 1821 FIREA allowing for the rights of the receiver. Of course, this court should wonder if it's a situation that the receiver gets to exercise his rights without regard for the receivership and its validity. And I point out that this court's decision affirming when this matter was before this court previously said right in it, the government caused Meritor to be forced into receivership, which it would not have been forced into.
Well, but
if this case
that doesn't mean that the receiver, therefore, every single act taken by the receiver was invalid or was somehow outside of its authority, right?
Well, we don't need to get to that point. Well,
that's where the whole challenge.
Well, except that the whole reason for FIREA and in particular that aspect which allows for receivership rights or rather powers is to deal with institutions which are undercapitalized and need to be put into receivership and then control over protection of the FDIC assets, meaning the insurance fund. In this particular case, the insurance fund does not come into play because it was decided by the court and affirmed by this court that the insurance fund was never implicated, and in fact, the receivership was not proper. And of course, it is a situation, and it's our contention, that in the event this case had been adjudicated prior to the case in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania and the Third Circuit, when it was assets, and the court wouldn't have been, then the receiver would not have been able to repudiate the agreement because it would not have been a burden on the estate.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you. We thank all counsel. The case is submitted.